Hello, everybody. This is the big day. This is the big one. This is the moment that some of us have waited quite a long time for, and it is the release of the episode 8 in Star Wars. Matt, we've made it.
Have we made it?
I think so. I'm here. But we are the Nighthawks, and we have a film discussion podcast where we ourselves like to stay up all night and pontificate about movies, and we do so often. And we invite you to do so whenever is convenient for you, because podcasting is not appointment radio. So we are going to be talking about Episode 8 and how we're going to do this. We understand that this movie just came out. Not everybody has had a chance to see it. So what we're going to do, we're going to have a little non-spoiler talk at the beginning of the episode, and then we're going to raise our usually loud and annoying spoiler curtain alarm, and we're going to be talking about spoilers on the other side of it. Now, I'm going to tell you right now, the lion's share of our discussion is going to be behind that spoiler curtain, because there's a lot going on in this movie. And I think the more that people find it cold, I think the better it'll resonate. So we want to offer that to our listeners.
My father wanted you to have this when you were old enough, but your uncle wouldn't allow it. He feared you might follow old Obi-Wan on some damn fool idealistic crusade like your father did.
The Force is with you, young Skywalker. But you are not a Jedi yet.
You got a lot of guts coming here after what you pulled.
Must unlearn what you have learned.
Hokey religions and ancient weapons are no match for a good blaster at your side, kid.
I suggest a new strategy, Artu. Let the Wookiee win.
You refer to the prophecy of the one who will bring balance to the Force. You believe it's this boy?
Has anybody ever seen a pod race? I'm the only human who can do it.
The bees are about crazy. We shall be bombed and crushed.
Help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi.
I'm one with the Force, and the Force is with me.
There's been an awakening. Have you felt it?
When I found you, I saw raw, untamed power. And beyond that,
something inside me has always been there, but now it's awake and I need help.
Raw strength only once before. It didn't scare me enough then. It does now.
Let the past die. Kill it. If you have to. That's the only way to become what you were meant to be.
Place in all this.
this is kind of a unique time. As I was prepping to watch Episode 8, when Episode 7 came out, I was fortunate enough to do an in-theater marathon run of all the, at the time, extant Star Wars films. And then the year following, Rogue One came out. And now as I was gearing up to watch Episode 8, I realized that between Episode 7, Rogue One, and Episode 8, over the course of 3 years, we have a whole new trilogy of Star Wars movies to watch. We come from a time where we only had three, and then we waited 20 years for the next three, and we're kind of disappointed by them, and they were released 2 years apart or so. So really, we're getting a lot of Star Wars in a brief amount of time, and I'm actually pretty excited about it. How's it leaving you?
I like a constant drip of Star Wars.
And so as we come into Episode 8, really, for the first time in Star Wars history, kind of picking up right where the previous film left off, we're given a little kind of recap over the crawl that maybe a few days or a few weeks have gone by. But as we pick things up, you know, our character Finn is still recovering in a Bacta tank from his encounters at the Starkiller base. Kylo Ren is still kind of nursing some of his wounds and they're in situ of being healed. The cliffhanger moment of Rey handing over the lightsaber, that exact scene happens again, and we get to see how that plays out. And so it's really fun to kind of just pick up immediately where they left off, where in previous years we had sometimes years going between episodes. This one is really a continuing saga, and honestly, this movie only takes place, it feels like, over the course of maybe a couple of days. And so really, it's a very tight story. It's really well done. I really, really like this one. And I actually think in the grand scheme of things, in the overall ranking, it's going to be really hard to beat Empire for me. And then New Hope, it comes in second because it's so iconic. It was the first exposure. It set so many things up. But I think Episode 8 I'm going to put in that number 3 slot. And we had a little discussion off mic on whether or not Rogue One would actually come above that or not. It comes above that for you. You said it's your favorite Star Wars film. And I don't know that I would argue that with you. I think it's just a matter of personal taste right now that I would probably put Episode 8 maybe just a hair over Rogue One. But, you know, I foresee that being something that I flip-flop on. And depending on the day you catch me and how I'm feeling and how subsequent watches of this film goes, it might change. But, man, these have definitely, out of the latest batch, these are definitely the two shining stars.
You know, what I said on the Rogue One podcast is that it's adult Matt's favorite Star Wars movie.
Rogue One is, yeah.
I think I'm going to stick to that because it's a different criteria. Part of the controversy is to a certain degree, we're aging out of the demo for Star Wars, period.
Yeah, that's true.
And that is, of course, that's what the extended property seeks to do, is rope in the older fan a little bit. But
this one worked for you. So how, I mean, I don't want you to give it a score or anything, but like, so just overall reaction without getting too specific.
It didn't do everything I'd hoped. And this is something we've talked about in our discussions of like, you know, I've talked about off mic in our discussions about copyright is when do canonical stories start to belong to the fan?
Mm-hmm.
And I would argue at the point that fandom ends and culture begins, the Christian cross is not copywritten. It can't be.
Right.
The swastika is not copywritten. You don't have to go to the Bureau of Nazis before you make them the bad guy in your movie. Nobody owns a ghost, but somebody does own a Sith. You know, nobody owns the Black Knight, but somebody does own Kylo Ren, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so we all have our ideas about where we'd like to take these canons. Episode 8 did not meet my perfect personal use case. That said, I think it's a really good sequel to Episode 7. If you pressed me for a score, I would give it an 83.5.
Did you like it better than Episode 7, or where would you put it in there?
I think I liked it a little better. I'd have to sit down and watch Episode 7 for purposes of ranking them, and that means it's close.
And we're going to talk about the fan reaction in a minute, and it's a hell of a conversation. But I think what I enjoyed about this, and what a lot of critics enjoyed about this, and what a lot of rabid fans didn't like about Star Wars Episode 8, is that Rian Johnson, who's a director that we haven't done a Rian Johnson film on the show yet, and that's a crime.
It's also quite peculiar because I think two of our mutual favorites are Rian Johnson movies.
Yeah. what he's done is he's really making a point of throwing out a lot of the Star Wars conventions. And by throwing out, I don't mean throwing up on screen. That's what J.J. Abrams did last time. What he's doing is throwing them in the trash. And I think people are taking umbrage to that because they believe it's being disdainful to the fan base. But I think he's doing it in such a way that it actually works. It functions. Once again, we're not going to get into too many specifics, but there really is a lot of allegory here. Number one, I think it's allegory for fan culture. And I think Rian Johnson specifically addresses certain issues that have been raised in the prequels and in Episode 7 that people complained about. Lots of, you know, very nerdy comic book guy kind of conversations that have happened. He addresses those. He attempts to fix some of the problems that have come up. But at the same time, he's also really making a case for why we're doing this new trilogy instead of the expanded universe that had been written about in Star Wars literature following the original trilogy and was kind of our Star Wars world when we were coming of age and teenagers and kind of coming into our know. And so there's a lot going on there, but I think he's also tying in a lot of modern social allegory, which is something that we have seen in the other Star Wars films. We have Star Wars films where the protagonists, Episode 7, Rogue One, now Episode 8, are largely female or people of color. And I think not only is Rian Johnson putting that out there, he is also saying some stuff about that. And I think that might be rubbing up on some people's politics a little weird.
Just
and
to dive into it, some, right?
Yeah. I mean, we can. Let's keep it spoiler-free. But yeah, go ahead.
It is a fair expectation that a galaxy long, long ago and far, far away is going to be at least as racially different from us as Brazil. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like, like, yeah, we have to cast with people that we have.
Yeah, we have to cast it with Earthlings.
This came up in Game of Thrones. Like, you don't have to perfectly recreate the brutality of medieval England to make a movie that's not technically set in medieval England. On that one, I kind of came down on the other side because I thought it helped with the world building and mm-hmm. it helped make it distinct from other fantasy properties to make it a gritty world. But I don't fundamentally understand the objection. And this is something that, like, we've seen, we saw it in Daniel Day-Lewis's character in Last of the Mohicans. We saw it in Tom Cruise's character in The Last Samurai. And here we are in discussing The Last Jedi. So there is a fundamental expectation in our culture that there will be a good analog for you on screen. If you is me and you.
Right.
But if you is the other half of the country, you know, and that's the go-round I keep having.
I said this in the Rogue One episode, but if you didn't listen to that, if you're catching this now, folks, this is what Star Wars is going to be. Either get over it or get out. Because, like, if you're not digging this, if this is what's going to be a deal killer for you, you're not a Star Wars fan anymore. This is what's happening. And it's going to keep happening because overall, it is a good thing. We talked a lot about that in the episode or in the Rogue One episode. And so I don't want to rehash old stuff. But this is an okay thing to happen. And it's okay if the guy on screen doesn't look just like you.
Well, yeah, especially if they don't look exactly like me. Like, I'd be much more implausible in an action scene than Daisy Ridley.
Yeah.
I am definitely not free climbing any data towers, which, by the way, I'm developing an overall thesis since our last episode on Rogue One.
Uh-huh.
I believe the entire world of the Force revolves around your elevation above sea level, right? So we've been familiar for a while with Jedi pit theory, which dictates the only way to truly kill a Jedi is with a pit and or by taking the high ground, which is sort of putting them in a pit. See, does anybody get pitted in this one?
There was a couple of stormtroopers that did, yeah.
So we see that in our modern Star Wars offerings, who are the survivors? They're capable of free climbing, which means they can do what? They can escape pits. So if you want to be...
Work on that.
If you want to be a Jedi someday, take yourself down to that free climbing gym.
So overall, Matt, walking into the movie after having watched the trailers, and I have to say there was probably less of a media blitz on this one than there has been in other Star Wars movies past, which is not wholly unwelcome. But do you think what was advertised was what was delivered?
I definitely think what was advertised was delivered. I saw a Star Wars.
And you know what? Ryan Johnson really seemed like he was breaking with a lot of Star Wars tradition. This movie doesn't look or feel like a core saga film, which, again, I think is what people are kind of objecting to. But it's so refreshing to see a unique take on this world again. And they are borrowing a little bit from some of the lessons that we learned and discussed in Rogue One. The war feels a lot more dire. The stakes feel higher. You don't know who's going to make it out from the beginning of one episode to the end of that episode. And they play it a little safer here than they did in Rogue One, but not a heck of a lot. The battles and the war portions of this, very graphic. It's violent. It's not R-rated violent. You can still take your kids to this. Yeah, it feels a lot more real. And stormtroopers can hit things now, which also helps. You know, they seem to be fairly competent soldiers. And so that
yeah, they
helps
seem like
well.
They're getting better.
They do. They do. They do seem like they're getting better.
Oh! Here's a new one. It's unrealistic that John Boyega fights Gwendolyn Christie in hand-to-hand combat because he would obviously just ragdoll her because he's a guy.
Oh no! Yeah, that's not true.
Yeah. Yeah, Gwendolyn Christie is actually bigger than John Boyega.
Yeah,
and she's not even before she puts on her robot armor. So we're not even. They don't even care anymore, but. That was a disruption, sorry.
Ultimately, if we can speak broadly, what worked for you and what didn't?
I can't talk about that specific. No, none of my concerns. My concerns are all specific enough that they can't be. They are not spoiler proof.
Just overall, in general, if we're comparing to the Force Awakens, one of the criticisms that movie draw, and I actually have to say that my estimation of the Force Awakens may have come down a notch or two after watching. Rogue One and then Episode 8. But one of the criticisms that was kind of lobbed at Episode 7 was that it was way too beholden to the original trilogy, that it was derivative, and the fan service was a little too heavy-handed. Do you think that was also the case in Episode 8?
You know, I didn't have much fan service trouble with Episode 8 per se. There's a B-plot in Episode 8 that feels like it literally happens on a different planet. It very much feels like it. It feels like it happens in a world of different stakes with a slightly different production design.
Mm-hmm.
And I had trouble integrating that. I liked it on a standalone basis, but I'll babble more about that behind spoiler curtain.
Okay. I liked a lot of the humor in this. I liked a lot of the there was just a lot of really genuine moments, and there was a lot of genuinely emotional moments, and the way that it played against my expectations was fantastic. And I think ultimately, bottom line, that's why people are angry, is because they had something built up in their head. And it was different from what was put on screen, because I think Rian Johnson set out to make something that nobody was expecting. And I think sometimes fans can be a little cruel with originality when it comes to situations like that. I think this worked well within the established rules of the world. The gender issue is a non-issue as far as I'm concerned. The color issue is a non-issue as far as I'm concerned. And honestly, once again, much like Rogue One, actually paints kind of a weird portrait of the rebellion and who they are and what realistically they would be in a galactic war scenario like that.
Well, and this is where we get our EU people versus our people that did not come of age when the EU was being published.
Uh-huh.
Right. And don't have that compare and contrast to right. The newer new coming fan. This world makes sense because the rebellion really spent itself barely killing the Death Stars through the intercession of specific fighter aces and Jedi who put them over the top by taking out the Emperor. They broke the Empire's fleet strength and lucked out, basically. And now it'd be just like if you were to assassinate the president of a modern country, right? Obviously, his military would immediately do a coup. Most countries,
right?
If you assassinated the president of Uganda, the Ugandan military would immediately take over. And so to me, the First Order is politically realistic. But in the EU, what happened is they so successfully routed the Empire that they took over the planet. I believe it's Coruscant.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how you're really supposed to say that. But they take over Coruscant and they start a new Senate very quickly. I mean, relatively quickly, canonically. So in 5 or 10 years, there's a functional government up and running in the galaxy. And so that's these people that their template of that is uncomfortable compared to their template of a rebellion that's still on the run in these new movies.
It's also important to note that they've done a little bit with the new expanded universe, where they talk about there were several factions that kind of sprung up in the wake of the Empire, and the Empire is so skillfully painted in both this movie and in Rogue One as being a really dysfunctional, it is a Borgia's level Roman Empire, Nero and Caligula. I mean, this is a backstabbing, bloodthirsty, cutthroat government. In the new expanded universe, they've explored a little bit about that here all these admirals and commanders were scattered to the stars when the Death Star blew up and the Emperor died, and they all kind of like, well, I have a Star Destroyer, I'm going to vie for power.
You had the grand moffs all thought they could be the next Emperor or Senate leader or whatever.
And so basically what we found is that the First Order in the first movie, spoiler alert for Episode 7, basically took out the New Republic in one fell swoop. Like, the Starkiller base was a great success. And what we're left with now is basically the what's left of the Resistance is on the run. And pretty much this movie is a high-speed chase. And again, not getting too spoilery, there's a lot going on in between that. I just think it was a really fascinating take. It was a different Star Wars story than what we've seen, but it was also still working within the realm of, we have analogs like we had in Episode 7. They're just couched differently, and they're not as apparent, so I think people didn't key into them as much. But, overall, there's been a really unfortunate fan reaction, and I think we'll get into the specifics on the other side of the spoiler curtain. But, Matt, before we do that, do you want to do anything in kind of summation, kind of maybe sell people? Are you recommending Episode 8?
I am overall recommending Episode 8, yes.
I am as well. I'll go so far as to say that I love every inch of this movie. It really hit home for me. It's among the better Star Wars movies that I've seen theatrically in my lifetime. I think you all should check it out. And it's, again, we've made this joke before, but I think everybody in the nation probably already has. But we are going to put up that spoiler curtain now, because unfortunately there's just not a lot we can talk about without getting into real granular specifics here. So, we're going to throw that up, and if you guys want to go in, and I do want to stress that this movie is going to play a lot better if you have as few expectations as possible. So going in blind is usually a pretty good move. So we're going to throw up that spoiler curtain. Matt, if you'd do me the honor of hitting the button.
Boop.
Magic of radio. So by way of a specific synopsis, what we're looking at is, and I do mean we pick up exactly where we left off. With the Republic in shambles, the Resistance has holed up and is evacuating their base. They're not quite sure where they're going to go or how they're going to do it, but as they are evacuating, they are beset upon by the New Order, who does a pretty handy job of taking out a lot of them. This begins a high-speed chase across the galaxy, which is going to be either ended by some kind of wild plan, or eventually the Resistance is going to run out of fuel and be overtaken. And so it's up to our core cast of protagony from the previous film to kind of spark things into motion and get things taken care of and see if we can get out of this sticky situation. However, Matt, one of the things I wanted to talk about is the tone and overall kind of feel of this movie is decidedly a little bit darker than Episode 7. Did you get that as well?
Yeah, it had that. It definitely had that middle trilogy feeling.
So that was going to be my next question. Does this serve as a functional Empire to The Force Awakens, do you think?
I don't know if I quite got to Empire.
Okay.
If there's a weakness to this movie, and I think there's a couple little things where I would wish for course correction.
Mm-hmm.
Right? They made this movie a little too long to make sure that it had an action set piece at the end. Like, really, this movie should have ended 2 hours in when they got to the planet. If they'd have done a Lord of the Rings and filmed this two at a time so it could come out in 8 months, they would have. And the next movie would start with the Hoth-like scene on the salt on Krat. I thought that was done. That was transparently done so that there could be a fight at the end of the movie. And I didn't see the need for the effort he put out to kill off Luke in whatever way it did. That's the big spoiler, right?
Yeah, I suppose so.
At the end of the movie, we see Luke use tremendous effort through the Force from a distance, and he ends up, air quotes, joining the Force. But we also did see Yoda is in this movie as a particularly involved Force ghost. And we've learned in the past, in the EU and in the cartoons and stuff, that the mortally slain Jedi is not necessarily gone.
Well, and I do kind of want to talk about that Yoda scene, because that's where I hang my coat on a lot of why I like this movie and why I think other people dislike this movie. And I think Rian Johnson, as I said before, is saying a lot, both sociopolitically and socially, as far as the political end of the fanboy spectrum goes. There's a scene where Rey has stumbled. She's joined Luke on the island. She's trying to coax him into rejoining the effort and giving a spark of hope to the resistance so that they can fight back. And she's not doing very well. Luke is a very troubled, very tortured individual. He's not the character that I think all wanted him to be. He's not this great wizard or grand warrior. He's Obi-Wan Kenobi. He's an old hermit living in the middle of nowhere. They're holed up on an island that is the location of an ancient Jedi temple. She stumbles upon her. She is called to by a series of books in this kind of treehouse, a very stylistic, very cool set piece treehouse. We're told through conversation that these are the sacred Jedi texts and this, that, and the other. Well, then later in the movie, Luke is trying to stop her from destroying the texts and succeeds. And in the meantime, as she's taking off, Yoda shows up as a Force ghost and says, "Hey, what are you doing?" And she's like, "She was trying to destroy the texts." And then Yoda kind of calls down a lightning bolt from the heavens, lights the tree on fire, and burns the sacred Jedi texts, and kind of leaves you with this, well, yeah, they had some wisdom, but it's nothing that she can't learn on her own. And I think that was actually a deliberate stab at the EU. I think that was Rian Johnson kind of saying, hey, listen, I get it. There is some good stuff in the EU, but we can give you good stuff too. We can do this on our own without leaning on that. And I think the conversation that's happening is that what's happening politically, where it is a literal government allegory of the downtrodden people finding hope to rise up and hashtag resist, and the penchant for fanboys to take things way too personally and to send death threats. And basically, we're talking about the Gamergate crowd that, you know, decided to move over to Star Wars for an afternoon. They're not good people either, but I think the selfishness that's rooted in the problems inherent in both of those cultures come from the same place. They come from the same place of pride and hubris. And so it's kind of unique to be able to address the meta fan situation and still have that grander political metaphor and have them work so well in tandem together. And so to see a Star Wars movie with that amount of craft or that amount of capital A art or that amount of allegory plugged into it was really, really fun for me.
The allegory didn't occur to me until later.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the reason I kind of lean on that so hard is because Rian Johnson really does tear down a lot of the Star Wars tropes here. You know, one of the big conversations that they had coming out of Episode 7 is, who is Lord Snoke? Who is he? How is he a thing? Who is he tied to? Is he the Emperor? Is he Darth Vader? Who is he? And Rian Johnson not only doesn't answer that question, but he kills the character off without answering that question. Because he's saying it's not about that. It's, you know, he's a bad guy. He has these Force abilities. We know this exists in this universe. And he's not somebody. He's just another Force-sensitive guy. He's not Darth Vader. He's not Rey's father. He's a Force user. They're like any other Force user in the galaxy, and he got really good at it. Now, he may have an adept background story, but you were saying, I'm sorry.
For the record, that's being leveled as a criticism, is they killed off Snoke and didn't tell who he was. When you kill someone in a technological empire, it doesn't erase all records of who they were. If at some point the dramatic reveal of Snoke's identity is productive, it can still happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, but I kind of like that it might not be a payoff. A better example of this is Rey's parents, which has been another big question mark that's been hanging over Episode 7. Now, whether or not you want to take what you learn in episode 8 as being factually canon, basically what's revealed is that Rey's parents were drunk traders. They're nothing special. They're not Luke's long-lost daughter. She's not some Obi-Wan cousin.
She's not a clone of Darth Vader.
She's not a clone of the Emperor, which has been out there too. She is just a regular person in extraordinary circumstances who is applying her gift, which I almost think is better than having a secret origin story that ties her to this grander saga that we've been growing up with. The fact of the matter is the first Star Wars movie, before any of that came out, before we found out that Darth was Luke's father, before we found out that Leia was his sister, before any of that, it was the story of a simple farm boy who did something extraordinary. And what we came to find out is it was actually kind of a King Arthur situation where the guy who had the royal blood gets his hands on Excalibur and then leads. He was raised among the commoners and understands their plight, but moves on to lead them to victory. But he still had that weird kind of birthright. And we've talked about this a little bit with Batman and Iron Man before, but I think it's much more remarkable and much more interesting to see a protagonist who is mundane. And so that's one convention he's breaking with. This stylistically does not look or feel like a Star Wars movie. He broke with that convention. So, I mean, I really think that this was Rian Johnson just kind of saying, hey, we got this. And I think he does. Now, it seems like there's a lot of fans disagreeing with me, but that was my read on it.
I think there's a lot of people that think they're Star Wars diehards that are bothered by it.
Yeah.
That somehow in the whole notion of geek culture, they become very caught up in what they think Star Wars is to them. But I don't think this is very disloyal to the original Star Wars. And some of the stuff they object to, like I wanted to see Luke do more cool stuff. Well, Luke is old now.
Yeah.
And he's come full circle. He's now the Yoda of this movie. The conflicted mentor that doesn't want to teach a new dark Jedi.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly, I thought the deftness with which Kylo Ren is pseudo-redeemed in this movie is really cool.
Uh-huh.
Like, he's not redeemed by any means.
No,
but he makes
quite
a
the opposite.
He makes a strong case for the Sith creed. He makes a strong, like, when he and Rey are essentially trying to corrupt each other. Each thinks they can win over the other at a certain point in the movie. And he makes a strong, like, your obsession with who your parents are and what your heritage is a limiting factor.
Yeah.
When he says that, it casts new light on his motivation and it resolves definitely the moment in episode 7 where he, spoiler alert, when he kills Han Solo.
Yeah.
There's this understanding that what he was ordered to do by Snoke is part of this overall monastic process that's part of becoming a perfect Sith. And then we also see him choke from doing it again when he can't fire on
his mother.
When he can't fire on Leia. And the other thing that does is it makes him, even though he does a little bit of a face turn in this movie and ultimately kind of sides with Rey, it also, he does so in a way that makes him look weaker.
Yeah.
Whereas Darth Vader overthrowing the Emperor at the end of the new trilogy was a play for dominance. Like it felt like Vader realizing he didn't have to be a puppet anymore, which he had been the entire time.
Mm-hmm.
Finally getting what was sort of deservedly his and taking the Emperor with him. In the case of Kylo Ren, it comes across like, oh, you're a little too mutable. You're not ready. You're not fully cooked yet. You're not ready. First you turn on Luke, then you turn on Snoke, then you turn back on Snoke. Then we dangle a girl in front of you and you turn girl, you turn for the girl, which, you know, which is what Anakin did.
I think they were playing with the convention of a turnaround for Kylo Ren as a way of building, almost as a red herring, almost as a way of building more conflict and more tension. I don't think they're going to go that route. I mean, I really don't think by the end of this trilogy of movies, Kylo Ren is going to be a good guy. I think we're finally seeing somebody who has turned to the dark side and is going to stay there. Again, that's breaking with kind of the norm, and I'm really excited about it because, again, it's something we haven't really seen or explored yet. Kylo Ren is one of the other things that in these movies that catches a lot of grief. Everybody's like, well, he's just a lame imitation of Darth Vader. Well, yeah, that's the point. They're making a point out of saying that because he has forged himself so hard in the Darth Vader branding, it's actually become a detriment to him. because he's not as strong and great and is not as laid in there and is not as under control.
Which, very interestingly, is speaking of things pseudo-redeem the prequel trilogy, right? One of the objections to the prequel trilogy is that Darth Vader was an imitation of Darth Vader. So how's Kylo Ren acting? He's acting like Darth Vader at his age.
Yeah, he's acting like Hayden Christensen.
Although he's doing it better because he's a better physical and acting fit for the part. But
well, and I think there's another thing to be said about the fact that he walks in, he makes his grand entrance wearing the Kylo Ren mask, and he's chastised for wearing it. He says, Snoke tells him to take that stupid thing off. And after that, Kylo Ren goes into the elevator and smashes it, and you never see it for the rest of the movie. So now we have taken this brandable, marketable, and I'm not just talking about within the realm of the movie. I'm talking about marketing outside to people like you and me as well. We have taken his iconic image and smashed it and said he is not just a pale Darth Vader imitation. He is his own complex villain. And if we're going to sell a few less hundred Kylo Ren masks at Halloween time next year, so be it. And I think that's gutsy. I think that's ballsy. I really like that. Because you know what? He doesn't have to wear a mask to be an effective villain. That's more fan service. The high points in this movie for me were definitely where this movie was kind of striking out on its own territory.
Also, it's ego. He's building himself up and making himself more intimidating, and he shouldn't need to.
Yeah, that's true. I was mentioning earlier that I think the politics of this movie might be turning some people off. Do you think that's a fair read? I don't necessarily want to get overly political. You can reckon this movie however you want to reckon it, but I think there is definitely a anti-establishment message to this movie. Is that my echo chamber, or do you think that was there intentionally?
Maybe.
I mean, specifically the current establishment.
I think people are over-mapping current politics onto it a little bit. Production on this movie was started before the election, right?
Not long before the election. And the election had been going for about a year before that.
I don't think it's meant to map perfectly onto any one real world leader, right?
Mm-hmm.
As tempting as that is to point out that it's a movie about an ineffectual redhead who can't even control his own underlings. The parallels are easy and obvious, but they always are. You can always sort of map any anti-establishment film onto the current establishment, right?
Mm-hmm. But do you think that's getting crossways with people who might not necessarily agree with that particular frame of mind? What I'm saying is some of the fan backlash, and there is a lot of fan backlash on this movie, is it political? Or is it that they just didn't like the movie?
I don't think it's intricately political. I think it's based on a false overreaction to a perceived political correctness on the part of the movie.
Okay.
They're too worried about representation. They're too hurt that there are too many women and not enough whiteys in it. It's an elemental identity politics argument. It's not a, like I just asked someone in an internet spat about this, like, because they said it's a very leftist movie. And I said, well, what's leftist about it? Did the Rebel Alliance try to give out insurance while I was getting popcorn? You know, where's the leftism in it? And it's invariably, you'll be drawn back to who's on screen.
Mm. So let's do talk a little bit about who's on screen by way of a clunky segue. Honestly, Daisy Ridley didn't knock me out this time. There was a few lines that came out of her that I'm like, ooh, was that necessarily the best take on that? But otherwise, I think everybody did roundly better than they did the previous film. And I don't think anybody was particularly bad at all.
Nobody stuck out at me glaringly. And this is another thing that comes from being old enough to have, this is going to go back to like being old enough to have watched the first trilogy in situ and watched it for itself. There is one Shakespearean actor in the original trilogy. Everybody else is a first timer. Perhaps not literally a first timer, but the relative unknown, let's say.
Especially for American audiences, yeah.
One of them in particular, Harrison Ford in particular, has been canonized since. And Mark Hamill works a lot, particularly in voice.
Uh-huh.
But it wasn't really filled with Oscar-winning actors to begin with. It was never really about that. Like Hamill himself said, and I believe he was relating George Lucas at the time, he said it's basically the most expensive low budget movie that we ever made. They worked with unknowns, and when they didn't have an effect, they built it, right?
Right. So that being said, I do want to talk about a weird cameo in here. Benicio del Toro shows up in episode 8, which was kind of a surprise for me. This is one of the ways that the movie surprised me pleasantly. That wasn't a traditional, oh, what a twist Star Wars surprise. But there's a scene where Finn and a new character, Rose, who is kind of a maintenance worker, and as the resistance gets whittled down, and boy, do they get whittled down, she has to take on a more active role in the rebellion. They're tasked with having to sneak aboard one of the enemy flagships and shut down a tracking mechanism that will allow the resistance to escape into hyperspace and for the First Order not to be able to follow them.
And that is where some of the strain comes in that keeps me from giving this movie a perfect score.
And so at one point, they actually have to get out of the chase and scuttle off to a planet where they can hook up with this master code breaker who is going to be able to get them past First Order security and where they need to be. And it turns out that this master code breaker is Benicio del Toro.
Well, we actually never quite find out if I think the guy gambling was really the guy they were there to get.
Oh, you do?
Yeah, I didn't quite understand if they really found a good one or not, you know? But at any rate, they retrieve a codebreaker who is skilled.
He himself is pretty morally ambiguous. He plays both sides against the middle quite handily, very much to his own advantage. But it was kind of weird to see him pop up there because he himself is a pretty recognizable individual. He's playing a very eccentric character, and in this case, not unlike Snoke or Rey's parents, doesn't get a ton of explanation. You don't really, like you said, was he the guy that they were there to get, or was he just a guy they happened to run into that matched that same set of skills? How did that integrate for you? Did that work for you?
They drop out of the chase. They leave the chase in progress and go through warp and do this side scene on this casino planet in order to meet and recruit this person. To me, that felt so odd to me because at that point, like, that's the one thing I kind of saw as a plot hole. I was like, given the number of people they're trying to work with, why don't they just individually leave in warp capable vehicles then? <You know? laughs> I mean, that did occur to me. Once they got there, the scene on the casino planet is great. Everything that happens there is great. But it did feel a little bit like it was out of a different movie, and it is the extra 30 minutes that makes it a 2-hour and 30-minute movie.
Mm-hmm.
It was there to make a point, and the point is contentious. There is a strong thread through this movie that Poe Dameron is not ready to be a leader yet.
Right.
That he still has things to learn. This is a special case. This is a very unique case because their brilliant plan fails. It fails badly, in fact.
Honestly, Matt, not a rebel or a resistance scheme in this movie that plays out. I think they're able to take down one enemy ship, which was a goal, against orders and with great loss to resistance personnel.
Yeah, and it's arguably that loss of ships is why they're in such a pinch later. And then Poe screws up his attempt to... They have a MacGuffin hyperspace tracker that's going to let them tell where the rebels go if they jump through hyperspace, which is why they're pursuing them through normal space, because they're trying to get far enough away from them to either jump or then ultimately it's revealed the rebel generals have a secret plan all along to get to this mothball base and fortify it.
Mm-hmm.
But in the meantime, Poe, who is furious that the leadership just seems to be running, lights off on his own with Finn and Rose. And they do a standard 2-pronged Star Wars movie assault on the baddies to try to shut down the tracker, which again looks like it's going to be a 1-way trip for them. You know, they're going to create a 6-minute window where the fleet can jump.
Right.
It just doesn't happen. Their plan doesn't work. They get their asses kicked on the ship. and I thought that was like, that's another thing. Like the thesis of this movie is a handoff of generational custody, right?
Right.
And so what they did is they kind of took a look at every Star Wars canard, and it didn't quite work. Right down to the lightsaber duel at the end, which doesn't quite go as advertised.
Uh-huh.
I thought all that was intricate. and interesting, but I didn't feel the set piece where they go and get the Codebreaker was perfectly integrated. Just put him in the brig in the Rebel ship or something. You know, just get him there. Although I love the, and I'm a sucker for all things casino. I love the Finn being easily distractible in the casino. I like that BB-8. BB-8 gets mistaken for a slot machine and a guy just keeps trying to put coins in him.
Well, see, and that was you know, that's the cantina scene. All the Star Wars movies have the cantina scene where you walk into a place and it's just asses to elbows with crazy aliens. And that was Rian Johnson's moment. And because he's Rian Johnson, of course, he puts it in a really ritzy casino. But even then, if you want to start really driving the political allegory home, this is definitely a 1%ers versus 99%ers conversation that's going on here. Yeah. Rose has a moment where she almost drops that, never has there been a more wretched hive of scum and villainy. You're expecting them to walk into Tatooine, and they walk into a ritzy casino, not to drive the point too far home, but it's gold-plated, it's full of tourists, and then when they kind of ask about it, when they're giving their little explanation of it, you're basically find out who are the people that are going to profit the most out of a galaxy that has been perpetually at war for 30 years, or even longer than that. It's the war barons, it's the arms dealers, it's the war profiteers, which I think in and of itself would be another interesting ancillary movie, but that's why I think this might have gotten a little politically crossed.
Then they steal a ship to get away, and they're going through the code, the transponder codes, to forge new ones.
Mm-hmm.
The Del Toro character, DJ, he says, well, let's find out who really owns this ship. And he's going through. And by the way, his character in this is basically Finster from The Usual Suspects, just in a weird hat. So which is why I won't even try to imitate his voice. They go through and they dig through and they're like, oh, look, he's a scummy arms dealer. Look at this. And they bring up like a schematic of a Star Destroyer and then a schematic of a TIE fighter. And look at this. He's selling arms to the
bad guys.
And then
guys.
The next one they click through is an X-Wing, and he goes, oh, look, he's selling arms to everybody. So DJ, the code breaker, he gives kind of this thesis that we're all just really on our side, and he's definitely the voice of the cynical fence. He's the Lando Calrissian of this movie. And in fact, I kind of thought it was going to be Lando Calrissian that got up off the bunk in the jail, and doing the turn again would have been peak Lando.
Yeah.
You know? But then especially once they got to the planet of Krat, the salt planet, everything that happened there was pretty cool. That was a pretty neat set piece.
Well, and so I do want to talk a little bit about what happens on the planet surface, and especially what happens with Luke. And another complaint that this has gotten, as you mentioned, is that Luke doesn't do enough cool stuff. And yeah, he's old, but there is a philosophy to the Jedi that often gets forgotten. And that is, they are first and foremost a peaceful, they promote peace and not striking out in anger, only striking in defense. And what we see is the perfect lightsaber duel between somebody who has become a disciplined Jedi and somebody who is attacking out of anger. And Luke fights an entirely passive battle. And it's important that he fights a passive battle, because he is fighting with the light side of the Force, and the true victory comes not from defeating Kylo Ren, but comes from taking advantage of Kylo Ren's hubris so that the rebels can go on and fight another day. And in doing so, not only creates a legend that is told around the galaxy, as we find out by the end of the movie, but also in just the preservation of his friends and this one core group of leftover resistance fighters that we have, which is not very many by the end of this movie. And so I thought that was kind of cool. And through that, I kind of like, oh, he finally found the most peaceful resistance against the Sith, and it worked. And that's what made him one with the Force. And so that was kind of my read on that. But I understand that is not explicit. That is headcanon. And so I can see where people might have had a hard time with that. But I do have to say, the death of Luke Skywalker, or the moving on of Luke Skywalker, it was tough, but it didn't hit me nearly as hard as Han did. That one was hard to stomach.
We know Jedi eventually pass on, and that they're pretty zen about it.
Mm-hmm.
Han Solo was still in denial. the other aspect, just a practical aspect that has to be discussed.
Yeah.
Is those guys are older.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's mean to make them come. And I mean, I guess you're paying them, you know,
right.
For what Harrison Ford made for episode 7, you could hit me with a stick all day, to paraphrase Danny Trejo. It's rough on those. Like, they had to be talked into doing it because they've wrestled with typecasting their whole careers. And they are physically, the role almost broke Harrison Ford. What he did in episode 7 was a little too much for it.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that they're going to be as they were is something that you just have to let go.
Right.
As an aging fan, you should appreciate that a little bit.
Yeah, I do.
That they're exploring what the role of age in the canon.
And this also leads us to the elephant in the room, which is, by the end of this film, we've only got one of our core cast from the original trilogy left. And unfortunately, it's the character played by Carrie Fisher, who has since passed on.
I think it needs to be discussed that she was physically failing while this was filmed. She is not at top form, and it feels scabby to point it out, but it's true. There are issues with her voice and her, I mean, just her physicality. And I guess her scenes for episode 9 are wrapped as well.
No, they hadn't started. That's kind of the problem, is they hadn't shot any of her stuff for episode 9, and they were kind of counting on her, from what I understand, being a big part of that. And so now we kind of have to figure out how that's going to work. So we have a couple of different options. Carrie Fisher has been brought back digitally before, albeit I wasn't wholly sold on the effect. We could recast, which I think would be probably a bad idea, or we just rewrite the story and have her not make it.
There's some things you could do. You could, there are a lot of options in the future to cover somebody's face, right? or make her a hologram, put some skin over her where that hides the CGI a little bit. But it's leading us into interesting legal territory too. Like, who gets paid for what she does in episode 9?
Right.
Her daughter, maybe? Who, speaking of cameos, her daughter is the deck officer with the faintly Princess Leia reminiscent hair.
Oh yeah. So I mean, do any of those appeal to you more? I honestly think the best course of action is probably to write her out. And I hate to do that because it seems like they were really giving her a good hero moment by being the last man standing. And I'd hate to take that, but like I just. This franchise has such a bad history with CGI characters that it's hard for me to kind of sign off on that. So, Matt, I think to wrap things up, give me a final thought on The Last Jedi.
I don't think it's the last movie. Bam, shallot joke.
Well, here's what I'll say. I like the direction they took this. It's not my favorite Star Wars movie, but it's up there. I really enjoyed it. I'm excited to see more of this. How about you?
What's interesting to me is the idea that the name Jedi and the religion Jedi and the religion Sith don't matter that much.
Uh-huh.
Because Snoke and Ren are never called Sith, even though they sort of conform to the Sith paradigm. Of course, that's always been the cynical interpretation of the prophecy about Anakin Skywalker, that he is going to bring balance to the Force.
Uh-huh.
Well, now it's down to four people, two on each side. That's balanced.
Right.
You know, or one. By the end of this movie, one.
Well, and actually, I do want to talk about this a little bit, because there has been drawn some criticism, and I think they talk about it in the movie a little bit. When Snoke is berating Kylo Ren about, you were defeated by a woman who had never even held a lightsaber before. And then he does kind of throw some explanation in there. It's like, well, as your powers grow, so will hers. Which gives you this impression that they might be somehow kindred or tied. But there's this complaint out there where it's like, well, how does she learn to become a Jedi and use the Force and do all these things so quickly? And I would make the argument that it's always kind of been that way. I mean, if you want to take a look at the grand amount of time that Luke studied under Obi-Wan, we're talking a matter of days. The total amount of time that Luke spent on Dagobah was a matter of days. So I think the actual art of using the Force and letting it guide your actions and using a lightsaber and lifting things with your mind, I think those are actually fairly easily learned traits for somebody who is Force sensitive. And we even have evidence of that in the movie. I think what you get with the years of training at the Jedi Academy, from a youngling all the way up to a Padawan and then on to a Jedi Master, is that Jedi settle trade disputes. And they're ambassadors, and they have to learn diplomacy, and they have to learn a hell of a lot of discipline, which is where I think Kylo Ren went south. So that's, I think, something that I'm building up a fanon in my head that I think people are kind of having a hard time with.
Like if you go to a Buddhist monastery to learn Kung Fu,
mm-hmm.
it's not the physical fitness part, the day-to-day heavy lifting that you learn there. It's the discipline to get up in the morning and do that.
Well, yeah, it's the 35 chambers of Shaolin. You know, it's there's an important lesson to be learned with each one, and they're not all necessarily how to punch a guy in the teeth.
And it's also the moral instruction about when to use the martial arts, right? Mm-hmm. So what we're dealing with here is basically like if you took an NFL fullback, I'm going to take you deep into sports metaphor country, Trevor. But if you took an NFL fullback and that had never thrown a punch before. And you took him, someone who was ready to be a hero. We'll say a clone stormtrooper is probably in pretty good condition, or a scrappy youngster that's been climbing and fighting and scrapping her whole life, right? Mm. And you take them and put them in a situation where they can utilize that training. They probably take to it pretty quickly.
Right.
We're shown a number of potential excuses why Ren didn't just overcome her. He was fascinated with her, and he's beginning to hedge his bets against Snoke by kind of, I'm going to say courting, but I mean philosophically courting her. Perhaps also literally, there is a definite shiny Adam Driver moment in this movie. speaking of which, I think a great movie would be a remake of Twins that featured Adam Driver as the good twin and Ari Shaffir as the bad twin. Just like, because they are just like this yin yang. Like Adam Driver is what Ari Shaffir would look like if he like worked out and lived good. But I guess they're a little different in age. But it is implausible, right? But it's always implausible when you take that guy and you put him in that situation and he learned to fight in a montage, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But like you're correct, it was implausible before, and nobody had a problem with it before,
right?
And it's also a question of F&M, man. It's magic. And I do think there's an element of, well, he's so much bigger than her. How come he can't just ragdoll her? Well, they're not competing in arm wrestling. They're competing in force use.
Yeah.
Which, yeah, he's had more training at. But the other thing is he's an underling. That's what part of what episode 8 gets into is his relationship with Snoke about how it's self-defeating. And one reason the Sith are always so disappointed in their underlings is because they make such underlings of them.
Right.
There's a price to be paid for that linearity. And that's why there's this pattern throughout the Star Wars movies of you get the guys, with maybe the exception of Count Dooku, who is sort of recruited as an adult. It seems to be that a Sith's second apprentice is the one that learns to scheme. That the first time they make themselves a Vader or a Darth Maul or a, you know, they make themselves kind of a dragon figure that is a strong enforcer. And then they find out, well, strong enforcers mostly just follow orders. That's the interesting thing about the transition that happens to Kylo Ren here is it's not from good to bad. It's from a Vader type character to something that's maybe going to be more of a Palpatine like character.
Right.
Oh, speaking of which, I want to give a quick note to the fight scene in Snoke's throne room.
Yeah, that was an excellent fight scene.
Because I just thought those dudes, the extras in the red Imperial armor, they use a weapon that like it's like made of parts, so it can be two axes, and then it can be a chain whip, and then it can be a sword, and then it's a conventional weapon, and the fine edge is lined in a little bit of lightsabery material.
Mm-hmm.
Rey and Kylo end up fighting against them together after. Kylo kills Snoke kind of sneakily while he's dealing with Rey. That was just a good Hong Kong style fight scene of just like this guy uses it. It was really it reminded me of Big Trouble in Little China. Like this guy uses this special weapon, this guy uses that special weapon. And so I just dug that, just in a pure fighty time to make the chimichangas, as Ryan Reynolds would say.
All right, Matt, well I think that's about going to wrap it up for this discussion of episode 8. Looking forward, episode 9, are you looking forward to it?
I am looking forward to episode 9 and to Solo.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about Solo. We mentioned it briefly during Rogue One, but this is the next kind of non-saga side story movie. It's going to be another prequel discussing kind of the world of young Han Solo and young Lando Calrissian, which on paper sounds like a great idea because that means I'm getting more Lando. They've got Childish Gambino, a.k.a. Donald Glover, playing Lando Calrissian, which I'm very excited about. But it seems like the production has been a little troubled, and they had to fire the original director, and then they have since brought in Ron Howard. And there was a little bit of that going on with Episode 9, too, where they had Colin Trevorrow, who had directed Jurassic World, was going to be in there, and apparently wasn't working out, and so now J.J. Abrams has stepped back in. And so do you think that's problematic? Do you have a specific read on that?
I'm not worried about that. I'm really not.
So, yeah, I don't know. It's always dicey when you have that situation. DC and Warner Brothers are kind of going through it now with their comic book properties where they'll run into a problem with the director and things don't come out so hot. We saw it also with Marvel when Edgar Wright left over creative differences on Ant-Man. Now, Ant-Man ended up being an okay movie, but it also wasn't that phenomenal. And honest to God, now that I've seen Rian Johnson's take on Star Wars, I'm not as eager to see J.J. Abrams back in the helm. Am I being unfair?
I don't know. I don't think of J.J. Abrams as a guy that screws movies up.
That's true, yeah. I mean, we would get arguments to that, but yeah, I'm with you.
He doesn't deliver a bad product, but he is kind of a safe choice.
And see, and that's why I'm way more concerned and way more into the new direction of Star Wars than going back to something, because I do think there is probably some grist or there is some weight to the argument that Episode 7 was a little too derivative and a little too steeped in nostalgia and fan culture. But the other side of that coin is that Rian Johnson has been offered his own trilogy of Star Wars movies. And so we have that to look forward to as well. So
is there any plot talk about them yet?
No, not yet. And actually, as far as the other non-saga films go, we haven't heard much about those either, except for Han Solo. So it's going to be interesting to see where Star Wars is going. And we mentioned this a little earlier, that the media blitz and the promotional blitz for this has not been as big as we saw for Episode 7. And I think we're going to continue to see kind of a scale back on that. I think they were dangerously close to oversaturating the market. And so I think we're going to see less and less news out of the Star Wars camp now that we're hitting a regular schedule so that they are able to surprise us a little bit more. And I'm okay with that. And you know what? Inevitably, not all of the Star Wars movies are going to be good. I think some of them are going to be pretty good anyway. And that's worth it to me.
There's one final thing we have to talk about before we wrap this.
Okay, what's that?
How did you come down on Porg?
I am pro Porg. I thought they
Team Porg.
I thought they were adorable little creatures. I thought they added a little bit of levity to the show, and they weren't overly dwelt on. They weren't Jar Jar, you know. They were in there just enough. They're around. You can tell there's a story going on between them and Chewie, but you don't know it. And I had fun with it.
Hey, I too am pro Porg. For the record, I thought they were totes adorbs, and agree that there's just enough of them. Another conversation could be had about the weird caretakers that appear and disappear like the trolls in Labyrinth. But I'll admit they're there to make a toy of.
Yeah.
You know. But one thing that I think I've mentioned this before, we need to talk about Chewie. We need to talk about the 300-year-old guy that's been there for all of this stuff and nobody ever just asked Chewie. To a lesser degree, R2-D2, but definitely Chewie. Nobody's ever like, hey, is Anakin Darth Vader? do you remember any of this stuff that have been there? Like, there should just be like Chewie and R2-D2 and Maz sitting down just like, told you so. I will say this, though. I would have turned my back and finished my roasted pork.
Yeah, I probably would have too.
It was so brown and crackly and delicious looking.
That did actually put me in the... It's like, man, I wonder if they still have those rotisserie chickens at the grocery store. I could probably do one of those.
Here's a tiny bit of trivia before we, as I was bringing up some pictures of Porgs. One of the, and this is from an article on The Verge. I should give some credit because I'm about to read a quote. But one of the interesting things I learned about the inclusion of Porgs in the film is that they're there to correct an annoying problem. The puffins that live on the island of Skellig Michael, the set for Luke's retreat, they're apparently everywhere on the island during filming, and the production team didn't want to remove them, so they came up with a stand-in to cover them.
Well, I'd say it worked. I'd say it worked. I enjoyed it. All right, folks. Well, thank you for joining us on this edition of Nighthawks Podcast, exploring Star Wars Episode 8. We'll be back, I assume, as more Star Wars movies come back, but we'll probably be back in the meantime, too. We're hitting into awards season, and that means Cameron's probably going to be dropping by soon, so you have that to look forward to, and yeah, just another good year of movies to come.
All award season praise for Get Out.
Word?
Oh, what's a good... What's a good Porg pun? Let's hope the next Star Wars Christmas special isn't a Porg-casted remake of Porgy and Bess.
God.
that would be true blasphemy.
Ugh, you're terrible.
Should we quit and go get some pie?
Yeah, let's do that. Ladies and gentlemen, we are going to sign off because it's almost morning.